Well, good morning. The court calls the United States versus Holton. Counsel to the appellant.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, my name is Captain Fred Abram, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, who represent the appellant in this case, Private First Class Reginald D. Halsey.
Just one question. Can you hear in the back? That's a yes? Okay, good job. Thank you. Carry on.
Your Honor, this court should set aside the findings in Private Halsey's court-martial because the military judge abused his discretion when he arbitrarily rejected Private First Class Halsey's guilty plea to AWOL based on a necessity defense that is neither recognized by military courts nor applicable in Private Halsey's case. The common law justification defense of necessity has never been included among the defenses in the rules for court-martial.
Just to be clear, the government has conceded error in this case, has it not, on the part of the military judge?
Yes, Your Honor. The government has acknowledged that in agreement with our brief that the defense of necessity does not apply in military courts or has not been adopted, and that also it likely wouldn't apply in Collins' case.
Is it necessary for us to decide your case to decide whether or not the defense of necessity applies, or can we do it on the basis of the fact that whether or not it applies, it wouldn't apply in this case?
Your Honor, I think that the appellant is in a strong position either way. This court can explore whether the defense of necessity does in fact apply or never applies. However, even if this court were to adopt some form of necessity or blended necessity defense with duress, the appellant would still...
I guess what I'm really getting at is, are we here to discuss prejudice or are we here to discuss the necessity defense?
Well, Your Honor, in light of the fact that the government appears to have conceded on the necessity, the existence of necessity as well as its applicability to Private Halsey, the central issue at this stage would appear to be the prejudice in Private Halsey's case.
Could I encourage you to discuss that?
Yes, Your Honor. The appellant in this case was prejudiced in a number of different ways by the military judge's wrongful rejection of his guilty plea. First and foremost, he lost his right to plead guilty that's been established by
Does one have a right to plead guilty? One has no constitutional right to plead guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's not a constitutional right to plead guilty, but the right to plead guilty is necessarily applied by this court through some of its opinions, for instance, in U.S. versus Penister as well as U.S. versus Diaz. Additionally, the rule for court-martial 910 obviously addresses the...
Is there prejudice on sentencing here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or is it just as a matter of findings?
Well, Your Honor,
and how is there prejudice on sentencing since this was a special with a sentencing, a jurisdictional limit under the Article 86 maximum sentence, let alone the Article 85 maximum sentence?
Your Honor, the appellant's position is that this court doesn't necessarily need to look to what the maximum sentences would be if it weren't necessarily at a special court martial. Obviously, the jurisdictional limit on the sentence at the special court martial was only a year of confinement. However, if you look to the amount of the severity of the sentence relative to what the military judge had the authority to adjudge, it was on the very high end, virtually the
most. Well, now you're arguing appropriateness, and we don't do that.
Well, Your Honor, it's not just an appropriateness argument. It's just the fact that this court should evaluate the degree or the proportion of the sentence versus the maximum that could have been adjudged versus what he ultimately received, which is essentially that maximum. The military judge obviously could have adjudged a sentence far less than 11 months.
Well, since you have a very lengthy absence terminated by apprehension, do you think the judge would have done that?
Well, Your Honor, that sort of ties back into the wrongful rejection of the guilty plea in the first place, in that it plainly stripped Private Halsey of various forms of mitigation that he could have had available in this case had the guilty plea been accepted.
It was the same military judge, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, like, he forgot that the guy tried to plead guilty?
Well, Plainly, Your Honor, he certainly recalled because the contested portion of the trial took place immediately afterwards.
You don't disagree that even if he had his guilty plea had been accepted, that the government would have been free to go forward with the greater offense and prove it up?
Your Honor, the government certainly would have been free to move forward with it. However...
So your prejudice is what?
Well, Your Honor, just once again, the fact that he lost the ability to plead guilty and have that tangible element of mitigation that a guilty plea provides...
Which didn't his counsel, even after the guilty plea providency inquiry was over during the trial itself, didn't his attorney argue that he wanted to plead guilty but he couldn't, so they're going ahead with this?
Yes, Your Honor, but there's a real question as to whether that's even something the judge is able to consider. Certainly a judge traditionally is not allowed to consider matters and issues that were discussed during the providency inquiry
But the judge made the determination that it wasn't provident, and that doesn't disappear. I mean, for whatever reason, the record reflects that he tried to plead guilty. The judge said, no, you can't do it. And so that's not erased from the consciousness of the court. So I'm having trouble figuring out why he had to go through the formal guilty plea inquiry in order to have that brought to the court's attention.
Well, Your Honor, once again, it's the appellant's position that it wasn't proper for him to consider what happened at the busted guilty plea. However, the idea that he can't...
But which way does it cut?
Well, that's exactly the point. It potentially cuts either way, and...
Then if cut in favor of your client?
Well, that from that perspective, the fact that he tried to plead guilty may work in Private Halsey's favor. However, the flip side of that is that this same judge who just moments earlier had this discussion with Private Halsey and clearly wasn't convinced that what Private Halsey was saying was genuine, or that Private Halsey was somehow attempting to defend his conduct rather than accept responsibility for it. He's the same one that an hour later is now listening to the government prove its case.
Well, it seems to me that's your client's problem. That's the appellant's problem. If the trier of fact doesn't find him credible, that's his problem.
Well, Your Honor, this court has recognized in the past that part of the value of a naked guilty plea, which is what was occurring in this case, is the ability of the defendant to keep out potentially negative issues and concerns that may arise if, in fact, he has to contest all elements of the offense. So that's been established as a potential concern and prejudice for this court, and that's what happened in this case. Private Halsey was essentially placed in the difficult position of at trial, trying to determine what strategy and what tactics to take, and whether he should testify, whether he should get up there and try and explain away the AWOL, whether he should just plead guilty to it himself on the merits. And then from there, what to do with the greater offense of the desertion charge that the government elected to try and prove up.
Counsel, if there had been a pretrial agreement in this case where the government had agreed not to pursue the greater charge, if the lesser charge was accepted by the judge and the judge erroneously found that it wasn't provident, then I can see some basis for your argument. But I don't see anywhere from the record here that we know one way or the other what the government intended to do. And, in fact, they had the cop from Miami that they'd called up to testify. So that kind of indicates that they were going to go ahead with it.
Correct, Your Honor. With the facts we have now, we obviously know the government was prepared and able to move forward with the greater offense. However, nothing in the record indicates whether the government actually intended to prove up the greater offense.
Well, how does that help you? There's nothing in the record here. Isn't it up to the defense? Doesn't the defense have the burden of showing that the case wouldn't have gone forward? And if there's nothing in the record showing that the case wouldn't have gone forward, where's the prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, unfortunately, it's obviously not clear, and that's sort of the inherent problem with the wrongful rejection of the guilty pleas. The case, at least as Private Halsey was able to prepare for it, jumped off the rails at the point that the guilty plea...
Why wouldn't he have been prepared to go forward on a desertion case where, in the circumstances of this, is there anything in the record that would have shown that he should not have been prepared to go forward on a desertion case?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record...
So, where's the prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, it's just that It goes back to just the fact that we're uncertain of where this trial could have and should have gone had it stayed on course before the military judge wrongfully
returned. Is it the normal course of a criminal trial that a plea is entered, and then after the plea is entered, if it doesn't dispose of all the charges, that you go ahead with the rest of the charges? What authority would there not be to not go ahead with the rest of the charges at that point? Is there anything in the record on that?
There's nothing in the record that clearly reflects one way or the other. The military judge didn't appear to discuss this at an 802 session or ask the government.
802 sessions? Where is there an 802? What basis would there be for us to rely on an 802 session that's not in the record?
Well, Your Honor, there wasn't an 802 session. So, but if there were, this is something that might typically be discussed between the military judge and the parties at the 802 session.
Counsel, you're speculating about what might have happened in an unusual circumstance. Again, why would we not assume that in any case in which charges are brought, the charges will go forward if they're not disposed of at a guilty plea proceeding? And there was, as I read the record, there was no entry of a guilty plea to the desertion charge.
There was not entry of a guilty plea to
the desertion charge. So, is there any reason for, again, I'm repeating myself, but what reason would we have under the record of this case to assume that it would not go forward as a desertion trial?
Your Honor, there's nothing concrete in the record that allows you to draw that conclusion. The appellant's position is simply that the government's case for desertion only consisted of the one witness on the merits. So it's not as though
they had a very lengthy absence terminated by apprehension. Doesn't that sort of smell of desertion, at least enough for the government to try and go ahead and try and prove it?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And there's no allegation of IAC here, is there, on the part of the defense counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Then presumably the defense counsel was prepared to defend. So where does that leave us?
Well, the defense counsel was prepared to defend, and Private Halsey obviously did put forth some testimony and submit evidence attempting to defeat the elements of the desertion offense. But this goes back to the fact that he wasn't able to plead guilty and lost that concrete mitigation they could have had with the accepted guilty plea. So now he's left in the position where he's kind of got to push all his chips in the middle of the table and say, I can't raise this as mitigation. So what other choices do I have? And he's left with getting up there and essentially conceding the AWOL portion of it and then trying to defeat the desertion elements. Because
conceding the AWOL portion, he tried to plead to the AWOL portion. That was his choice.
Correct. And at the guilty plea, obviously, he was willing to. And then at the contested portion, he really, after the government presents its documentary evidence to establish sort of the first three elements of the AWOL, he doesn't even contest that at the merits and focuses his defense on obviously defeating the elements of the intent to remain.
Your argument seems to be that it wasn't easy for the appellant, that it made it harder. Maybe so, but how does that amount to prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, the prejudice in the appellant's case is ultimately that he loses that mitigation. And that
is there any indication in the record what that mysterious mitigation would have been?
Well, there's not necessarily anything in the record, but the idea that a guilty plea has been recognized by this court, and it's in the rules for court-martial and in the military judgment bench book as well, that it is, in fact, firm or tangible evidence of mitigation, and that the appellant is potentially saving the government time and also accepting responsibility for what he's done. So That's the true prejudice in this case. He wasn't.
Well, I mean, I go back to the question that was asked earlier. You can't unring the bell. He tried to plead, and the judge wouldn't let him plead, but the judge knew he was trying to plead and save the government money and time and expense.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the appellant also essentially is relying on the fact that that bell can't be unrung and that by rejecting the guilty plea, that the course of the trial changed, and any tactics or strategy that he may have attempted to employ by taking advantage of that guilty plea were lost. And it's certainly it's difficult to unring the bell, and it was difficult for Private Halsey to determine what course of action he could take. And he was essentially boxed in to then having to try and still sort of toe the line and essentially not contest the guilty plea or not contest the offense of AWOL during the contested portion, and then left with trying to figure out what's his mitigation at this point, or what else can he do to potentially beat the desertion charge, or at least alleviate some of the sentence, which obviously could happen if he wasn't convicted.
Well, since he was facing a special, you've got substantial alleviation already.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. If I could just have a moment to conclude. This court should set aside the findings because the military judge abused his discretion, and the prejudice to Private Halsey was his inability to plead to demonstrate mitigation in front of the court martial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel of the government, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Daniel Carnot. Along with Major Robert Rodriguez, we represent the United States in this case. Facts of this case show that Pellant was not prejudiced by the military judge's error, and there are three main reasons why. Pellant stands convicted of the greater offense, desertion terminated by apprehension. Second, Pellant had no pretrial agreement in this case. And third, Pellant's sentence was appropriate and severe, given the real reason he deserved it, and the fact that he impeached the military judge's findings in his unsworn statement. To begin, Appellant was not...
Why are you arguing sentence appropriateness in front of us? It was appropriately severe?
Why
take that to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Why are you arguing that here?
I was just trying to get to the point that the real reason he deserted was that he actually was avoiding another unrelated court-martial that was never resolved, and that would be a reason why he wasn't... prejudice in this case.
Do you have anything to add beyond that? What's in your brief to your prejudice argument?
Beyond what's it? A few things, Your Honor. Specifically, the reason, again, why he initially absented himself was actually because of an unresolved court martial. I believe, we talked about in the brief, that it was a court martial out there. But in the record actually states, in certain first class early. Yes, sir.
Oh, no, I'm just these things. Don't be distracted by the hand and arm signals.
Gotcha. Sir, first class Orange testified that the court martial is actually unresolved. So, I mean, that's something for this court to also consider. And also, he not only impeached the military judge's findings in his unsworn statement in the last couple of sentences, which is in the brief, but he also brought that up to four, where he states, earlier in his unsworn, he states, quote, "I did not try to be a deserter, and I was not trying to hide. I wasn't trying to run or anything." So that's another instance where it shows maybe a reason why the military judge gave him that 11.
You didn't mention the relevance, if any, of the fact that it was before a judge alone. Does that mean the government believes it would be just the same whether it had been before members?
Well, that would only go towards basically that the military judge was also the fact finder, and that he was aware that the appellant had tried to plead guilty before.
Is it, in a general sense, perhaps not in this case, but in a general sense, is it mitigating to plead guilty?
Yes, Your Honor, generally. Specifically in this case, however, we know, for one, that it was a judge-alone case, and he was the same military judge, so we know that... You know, he understood that the appellant had tried to plead guilty. And even if this court doesn't look at what happened in the Providence inquiry, like right after, you know, the very beginning of opening statements, appellant's attorney, you know, he says, the appellant does not contest the fact that he was absent from his unit. He attempted to plead guilty. He wanted to plead guilty for that. He wanted to take responsibility for what he did. So from the very beginning, appellant's attorney and defense counsel, you know, stuck to their theme and theory of focusing on contesting only the last two elements of the desertion charge, that the intent to remain away and terminated by apprehension. So they stuck with their theory, they doubled down on it, and they said, you know, look, he tried to plead guilty. He already tried to do that. So they got all that mitigation evidence out there. And then at the end of the trial, pre-sentencing, appellant actually testified in his own sworn statement that he was sorry for Abel. So again, they basically bookended their case in chief and then into pre-sentencing even, basically showing that appellant had actually tried to plead guilty to the charge.
How do you answer the appellant's contention that, you know, whatever happened on sentencing, since this was a special, that he was prejudiced as to findings because he ended up being convicted of 85 instead of 86, which is a substantially greater offense?
I would say, Your Honor, that it goes to the fact that he was actually proven guilty of desertion. There's nothing in the record that would indicate why appellant would have not been guilty of desertion. And it kind of goes to...
Well, is there anything in the record that indicates that the government was going to go after the desertion anywho, even if there had been a guilty plea to 86?
Yes, sir. There are some indications. It wasn't explicitly said. However, there are a few things. First, we know that the government, well, you know, first and foremost, charged desertion on the table. Second, government had their evidence of witnesses lined up. They had the company commander, that Miami detective, ready to go, and that was despite the short 90-minute recess. So they had these witnesses and evidence lined up. And also, the defense stuck to the original plan of only contesting those last two elements. So the defense stuck to their guns, and basically everything was focused on those last two elements, which was ultimately established in the desertion charge.
Counsel, I didn't see it in the brief, but has this court ever held that the defense of necessity is precluded in the military justice system?
No, Your Honor.
So in that context, are we bound by the government's concession that there was error in this case? That is, why would it be error for a military judge in those circumstances to explore the defense of necessity?
It wouldn't be so much error in that saying that there are cases out there that suggest there could be a blended necessity defense, blended with duress and what have you. What the military judge, in his explanation of that, that wasn't what was the error. The error was, and after explaining all that to the appellant, he didn't make the further factual inquiry to go back and say, okay, well, now that you've said something about your, you know, having to help your kids, having to help your family, all that dialogue in the record up to that point was talking specifically about the reasons he went back. And because AWOL and desertion is an instantaneous offense, he had the duty to go back and say, well, let's go back to the real reason why you originally left. And the reason he gave during the province inquiry was, quote, because he wanted to.
Let's say that the military judge, let's assume that the military judge did not establish sufficient facts to accept a plea in this case. What case stands for the proposition that under those circumstances there would be prejudicial error in the judge allowing the case to go forward? That is, our court has urged repeatedly, since Kerr and probably beforehand, urged military judges to lean forward and closely examining guilty pleas to make sure that an individual is not pleading guilty to an offense that the individual doesn't admit guilt for. So if the military judge errs by perhaps leaning too forward in a case, have we ever said that that then constitutes prejudicial error in terms of the case then going forward to trial?
I don't believe so. The closest case I think is on point that comes to mind is U.S. v. Penester, which was a 1987 Court of Military Appeals case. In that case, basically it said, you know, insofar as the quantum of evidence is concerned, remedy available of disproving so much as a sentence that exceeds that which could be imposed by a special court-martial. However, the Court of Military Review perceived the change of form from the special court-martial to the general court-martial may prejudice the appellant. But, I mean, Basically, there is no, we wouldn't say that the military judge erred in leaning forward too much. If anything, I mean, that's, I think it's a policy, good policy for a military judge if they think that there's a mere possibility of a defense to explore that. However, in this case, going back to the facts of this case, the record establishes that the military judge, he didn't do that. You know, he went too quickly and decided, okay, it sounds like you have a necessity defense, well, let's go straight to trial. He had that duty to explore the factual background to establish whether or not there was actually a possible defense. Here, there's only a mere possibility, or not even that.
So is it the government's view that if the military judge establishes no more than a mere possibility and then goes ahead and precludes the plea, that constitutes an error which will be tested then for prejudice with respect to what actually happened after that? I'm trying to figure out what the government's position is here. That is, in every case where the judge precludes a guilty plea, then we have to then go ahead and assess the prejudicial effect of that preclusion. You're not going to take the position then that a judge who establishes a mere possibility, that in itself would be sufficient to sustain the verdict in the case when the case goes forward.
No, Your Honor. We wouldn't go so far as to say if the military judge only had found a mere possibility and did not further explore that, then that would necessarily, we'd say that was necessarily, prejudicial. I mean, it would always go back to the analysis of, whether or not he abused his discretion.
But you're saying that it's an abuse of discretion in every case where the judge merely establishes the mere possibility. That's an abuse of discretion in the government's view. And then we test that for prejudice. You're not taking the position that where the military judge establishes a mere possibility, that's sufficient with respect to letting the case go forward.
I believe we agree with the former explanation, Your Honor. Okay.
Are there any other questions from the bench? Would you like to summarize?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. Consequently, appellant was not prejudiced as the error did not have any substantial influence on the findings. Appellant was convicted of the greater offense of desertion. Even if appellant was able to plead guilty in this case, the government would have proved in the last two elements in it. The military judge's rejection of appellant's plea did not alter the potential maximum punishment, as there was no pretrial agreement in this case, and the form of the court-martial is special court-martial. Appellant's sentence also was severe enough in that he deserted to avoid an unresolved court-martial, and also appellant impeached the military judge's findings multiple times in his own unsworn statement. As such, his honorable court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case.
Now, I have one question to follow up. What happened to the first court-martial? Did it just disappear into the ether?
It appears so, Your Honor. From the only evidence we have in the record is from Sergeant First Class Earl, where they specifically asked him, do we know what the result of that court-martial was? And he basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically says that to his knowledge, it was unresolved.
And thank you. That.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, please.
Your Honor, just real briefly on the alleged court-martial that the government is maintaining Private Halsey attempted to avoid. There's no evidence that's brought forth on the merits. That's something that a witness brings up on sentencing, and we're left to speculate as to whether that was a special court-martial, summary court-martial, at what stage that alleged court-martial may have been at. So the appellate would urge this court not to put much weight into the fact that that's been mentioned repeatedly by the government as something that did in fact exist. We simply don't know. It's based on First Class Earl's testimony on the sentencing.
What's your response to the government's response to the 85-86 argument? that the appellant wanted to plead guilty to a UA, was prevented from doing so, and the government proceeded then on desertion. And is there any prejudice there? And the government's response is that's not prejudicial because they're going to proceed with desertion anyway, as evidenced by the fact that they had their witnesses hanging around.
Well, Your Honor, this takes us back to just the central point that when the military judge abused his discretion, this trial took sort of a left turn, and we don't know for certain whether the government was actually going to prove that case, whether they were going to attempt to prove up that offense. They had one witness standing by, and that's essentially the extent of the efforts that they were required to put forth. So while they obviously were able to prove up the offense, they certainly didn't exactly have an exceedingly strong motive based on preparation or difficulty of getting witnesses and evidence into court to prove up that offense. So this would have been a case that would have been right for the government to say, okay, you've pled guilty to the absence itself. We've gotten our pound of flesh, and we can just go ahead and move forward with sentencing.
Well, why else would they have the police officer from Miami there, other than to prove the apprehension?
Well, Your Honor, just potentially for a situation just like this where the plea does fail, and they do want to be able to move forward with it, so it's excuse me, so that they do still have all their options available to them. They wouldn't want to just foreclose those.
While we're speculating, which do you think is more likely, that that they anticipated that a guilty plea to a UA was going to fail, or that they had the officer there to prove up the apprehension? I mean, a straight up UA plea is not very difficult to accept, is it?
Generally, it's not, Your Honor. So certainly the probability of that would have been low, but the government still could have had that witness there, even if they weren't going to use him on the merits, to potentially use him in aggravation on sentencing to describe sort of some of the additional circumstances surrounding private business.
Thank you.
To Judge Efron's question concerning a military judge's discretion to reject a guilty plea, we would agree with the government that Penister is certainly the seminal case that sort of gives the sort of the ceiling of what his discretion is in terms of accepting or rejecting a guilty plea. And in this case, the government, or I beg your pardon, the military judge abused that discretion by applying and misunderstanding a legal principle, in this case, the necessity defense, which doesn't exist, and
Counsel, you said the necessity defense doesn't exist. I recognize that there may be a unique circumstance in this case where this appellant and the government are interested in not having a necessity defense in the military, but again, I'll ask the same question that I asked the government. Is there a case in which this court has said the necessity defense does not exist in the armed forces and cannot be raised?
Your Honor, the closest case on point with this court would be U.S. versus Rankins, where the court actually acknowledged that there is a distinction between the two defenses of necessity and duress, and while they didn't necessarily have to make a holding on necessity, the court expressed extreme concern about adopting necessity from the bench rather than allowing the executive or the legislative.
Did that case state that there is no necessity defense in the armed forces?
It stated that necessity has never been recognized by the military courts and the armed forces.
Does it preclude the raising of that defense in that case? Did the court say it cannot be raised?
The court does not slam the door on the necessity defense in Rankins or Allinger or Rockwood. Your Honor, the appellant was prejudiced by, if I may just have a moment to conclude.
Of course.
Your Honor, the appellant was prejudiced in this case by losing mitigation in front of the sentencing authority, the convening authority, and ultimately the Army Court of Criminal Appeals by not being able to plead guilty and maintain the concrete mitigation of a guilty plea.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we'll stand in recess until 10:15. Thank you.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:15.